This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
On today's program, We the People, Not We the Corporations, overturning the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. First, a discussion on the court's decision on local judicial elections.
We're going to talk about bowling for dollars. Well, that's one thing, but really, what about judging for dollars? We rarely discuss the ways judges are picked at all levels and the role politics and money play in judicial selection, particularly in the entry-level courts. So judging for dollars with Adam Skaggs, counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law.
Thanks for having me.
Well, absolutely. Adam, really, much has been made about how the case of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which was the recent Supreme Court decision that lifted the ban on corporate spending in elections, which will allow special interests to dump money into presidential and congressional races, was decided. But the decision was handed down, in the words of Justice John Paul Stevens, just when concerns about the conduct of judicial elections had reached a fever pitch. So will Citizens United likely create an explosion of special interest spending in this year's judicial races that threatens to further erode the judiciary's independence?
Well, I think that's a real concern. I think you could say that Citizens United has the potential to exacerbate an explosion that is already going on across the country in state judicial elections. What we've seen over the past decade is really already an explosion in spending, both on the end of fundraising by candidates themselves, who raised more than double the amount of money in the past decade than they did the previous one. Just to give you a sense of the figure, from 2000 to 2009, candidates raised almost $207 million to run for high court seats in various states, and that's more than double the $83 million they raised in the previous decade. But not only have the candidates themselves raised money, but special interest groups have been pumping money into these elections in an attempt to gain influence or gain control over who controls the state high courts. So, for instance, of $93 million spent on TV advertising in state high court races over the past decade, special interests were responsible for more than 40% of that spending. These are outside industry groups that want to place sympathetic judges on state high courts. So they've been running a tremendous number of ads. They've kind of become the attack dogs of judicial campaigns, running the most negative personal attack ads. And as you suggest, after the Citizens United decision, which essentially opened the door to corporate independent spending in elections, in federal elections, state restrictions on corporate spending have also been struck down. And we can, I think, expect to see only an increase in the amount of money special interests are pumping into these judicial contests.
So let's look at the selection process in, for example, New York Supreme Court, Court of General Jurisdiction, and for that matter, New Jersey. How does this comport with the selection of judges in those two venues?
Well, those figures I just gave were for high court races, the equivalent in any given state of the United States Supreme Court. In New York, the highest court in the state is called the Court of Appeals. In many other states, it's the Supreme Court of those states. So the biggest spending we've seen by these groups is on those high courts. But in New York, some of the worst election abuses that we see are in the what we call the Supreme Court here, which is not the highest court. It's the Court of General Jurisdiction, so basically the basic trial court across the state. And what we've seen there is concerns with money. For example, there have been abuses where judges have awarded law guardianships, for example, to campaign contributors. Brooklyn, there have been a number of judicial selection scandals in Brooklyn where the county bosses who control access to seats on the bench have demanded that candidates hire their political cronies if they want to have a chance to be elevated to the Supreme Court. So we've seen these kind of abuses. Now, in New Jersey, there have been a slightly different sort of questions and concerns raised. New Jersey doesn't have elections. They don't elect their judges. Their judges are appointed by the governor. And historically, that has worked well. Governors have respected judges appointed by previous governors, even of other parties, and have reappointed them when their terms come up as a matter of course. Lately, however, Governor Christie has decided that this tradition of respecting existing judges is no longer something he wants to be bound by. He refused to reappoint the only African-American judge on the Supreme Court of New Jersey, Justice John Wallace, Jr., and decided when his term came up he wasn't going to appoint him. He was going to appoint instead a lawyer with more sympathetic political affiliation. That has outraged members of the New Jersey Bar. All the members of the Judicial Nominating Commission in New Jersey have resigned in protest. And Christie has really unnecessarily created a real firestorm. So in New Jersey, what we see here is, unfortunately, injection of partisan politics, partisanship into the judicial selection process. And I think that's the other side of the coin of money in our judicial election system, is an injection of really intense political and partisan concerns. And all across the nation, this influence of money and this influence of partisanship is undermining public confidence in the courts as a place where anybody can go to get a fair shake, a case where anybody who shows up in court is going to have a fair, impartial, unbiased judge. Unfortunately, because of the vast amounts of money and because of the influence of partisan politics, people are beginning to have questions about whether that promise of a fair court is really something they can expect.
So the obvious question is whether special interest spending sways judges once they're presiding over cases.
Well, that's right. And of course, we have yet to find too many judges that come right out and say, hey, you know, I decided that case because the one side gave me more money than the other. We just don't see that. But what we do see is surveys that confirm again and again that the public has real questions about whether political campaigning, whether campaign contributions are influencing the decisions that judges reach. And all too often the answer there is yes. A number of surveys have confirmed that 3 out of 4 Americans believe that judges are influenced, at least in part, by who gives them campaign money. Similar numbers of Americans think that whenever somebody who's given money to a judge's campaign appears in court, that judge should step aside and instead have a wholly impartial judge hear that case. And as alarming as those numbers are, perhaps the most alarming numbers are that judges themselves actually believe this as well. In a survey of more than 2,000 state judges, nearly half, over 40% of judges themselves believed that judicial decision-making was influenced by campaign contributions. Now, of course, the psychology being what it is, I'm sure each one of those judges who said there was an influence thought it was other judges who were influenced and not him or herself. But the fact of the matter is not only the public, but even judges, as well as members of the business community, members of the trial lawyers associations, all these groups have been surveyed both at a national and various state levels, and the numbers have been consistent. The public has real concerns about the influence that money has on what their judges decide in the courtroom.
Well, we have judges who are even running unopposed now who have collected hundreds of thousands of dollars in contributions from litigants, frequently within days of when the judge took action in the contributor's case.
Well, that's exactly right. And one of the worst examples of what you just described was revealed in a Los Angeles Times study of judges running for election in Nevada, where, as you suggest, campaign contributions were dated within days of times that judges made rulings in the cases of the very people writing the checks. So that's been a huge concern in Nevada. And the attention in the press that these abuses have gotten in that state have actually led to a movement to scrap elections entirely and replace them instead with a so-called merit selection system. So voters in November in Nevada will have an opportunity to get rid of their judicial election system and adopt one of these merit systems. These have been advocated by a wide range of policymakers, lawyers, and others across the ideological spectrum. The biggest proponent for replacing elections with merit selection systems is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And after she retired from the United States Supreme Court, she has really made adopting these sort of merit selection programs her signature issue. The way these function, a nonpartisan commission evaluates the candidates for openings on the bench. These commissions are nonpartisan, so no one political party or the other is able to dominate them. They are designed to have a balance between attorney members as well as non-attorney members of the public. And these commissions evaluate potential nominees for judgeships based on experience, based on qualifications, not based on their ability to raise money or their connections to political allies. They then nominate candidates to the governor, who appoints one of these judges to the bench. Then they are periodically subject to retention elections. So if, through this process, a judge is put onto the bench who ends up being way outside of the mainstream, the public does have an opportunity in a yes and no vote to vote to keep the judge or not.
Well, I don't want to dampen that too much. I am interested in looking at things such as public financing systems for judicial election. But certainly in the process of New York, when you look at entry-level courts, the selection process, not the election process that does ensue in the housing court and so on, is one that is still rife with special interests making greater determinations on the political composition and character of the judges. And they're not going to be appointed if they are outside of the mainstream or if they are, for example, not supported by the Rent Stabilization Association, which has enormous sway. So it still seems to be a system that is very partisan and represents money interests in any event.
I think that's exactly right. I think New York, in some ways, may have the worst system of any. It's formally an election system in that voters in November in New York will go to the ballot box and have an opportunity to vote for judges, but very few New Yorkers will know much about those candidates. Those candidates will have been pre-selected, pre-screened at political nominating conventions. And these conventions are entirely controlled by the party bosses. So the county political bosses essentially run these conventions. They handpick who they want to be judges. And these candidates they select, they're not choosing these people on the basis of their stellar qualifications or their excellent resumes, if you will. These are being selected on the basis of political favor trading. Folks who have agreed to hire hand-picked cronies of the party bosses will be rewarded with nominations for judgeships. Unfortunately, the voters, faced with very little information about who these candidates are, frequently go in and vote on party lines. So in the city, we see a lot of Democratic judges. In some of the counties upstate, we see a lot of Republican judges just being, again, picked by these party bosses and then, in effect, ratified by the people through a formal vote in November. The Brennan Center, where I work, sued several years ago to get rid of this system, to create a primary system where voters actually have a meaningful input into the process of selecting judges. Ultimately, that lawsuit was unsuccessful because the United States Supreme Court stepped in and said, while this appears to us to be an unfortunate selection system, if the legislature of New York has chosen it, so be it. That's their decision, and it's not for the courts to strike this down. But in that litigation, the district attorney of Brooklyn, Charles Hines, who has put party bosses in jail for selling judgeships, said, and I think very accurately, that this selection system is the last vestige of Tammany Hall in New York. Tammany Hall used to control who ran the legislatures and the executive offices. Fortunately, those sort of party politics, party boss-controlled systems have been diminished for those branches, but unfortunately, it has persisted in the selection of judges. So the judiciary, which should be the least political branch, unfortunately in New York remains to this day the most political branch.
So as we wrap up, what is to be done, Adam? What's a better mechanism than what we have at this juncture?
Well, I think if we're going to retain elections, you suggested earlier public financing. I think that's a great step forward to get judges out of the business of dialing for dollars. I think we can also create better disclosure rules so we know who's funding those campaigns, and we can adopt strict disqualification rules so that judges never hear the cases of those who control their access to their positions. And other than that, I think we need to explore merit selection systems like the type they have in Connecticut and other states across the country, where politics and money-driven fundraising are pulled out of the process, and instead judges are selected based on their experience, their qualifications, and the likelihood that they'll apply the law without favor rather than hoarding and giving favors to their political cronies and or their campaign fundraisers.
And it should be obvious, but why should we care about how our judges are picked?
Well, I think we should care about how our judges are picked because it influences how our courts are perceived and how they do their job. The courts play obviously a unique role in our system. They're the only branch where everybody gets a fair shake. Nobody should be favored depending on their political clout or how bad a check they can cut. And unfortunately, when the public loses faith in the judiciary as being a place where everybody gets a fair hearing before an impartial court, courts can no longer do their jobs. They cease being that place where anybody can go to get an impartial trial.
Well, if in the Citizens United era states don't adopt public financing and strong disclosure disqualification rules, the judiciary's credibility will dissolve, and quickly. Adam Scabs, attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mimi.
It's a new day. Till now, corporations influence politics with high-paid lobbyists and backroom deals. However, as much as corporate interests gave to politicians, we could never be absolutely sure they would do our bidding. But today, thanks to an enlightened Supreme Court, corporations now have all the rights the Founding Fathers meant for us. It's our democracy. We bought it, we paid for it, and we're going to keep it. That's why Murray Hill Incorporated is taking democracy's next step, running for Congress. The way we see it, corporate America has been the driving force behind Congress for years, but now it's time we got behind the wheel ourselves. Murray Hill Incorporated will bring enlightened self-interest and corporate accounting to government to put business first. It is a vision for the future we can all be proud of. Now that democracy is truly for sale, Murray Hill Incorporated is offering top dollar. Vote Murray Hill Incorporated for Congress for the best democracy money can buy.
I'm Eric Hensel, designated human for Murray Hill Incorporated. We approve this message.
Now the march to overrule the court. Ben Mansky, executive director of Liberty Tree, along with Lisa Graves, executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, spoke to a rally at the Wisconsin State Capitol. The demonstration was organized in coordination with MoveToAmend.org and the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign.
On January 21st, five members of the U.S. Supreme Court dealt a heavy blow to American democracy. They ruled that corporations are persons and that the government must protect corporations against we the people. Susan B. Anthony, the great suffragist and abolitionist, she was born today. I found that out this morning. And you know, if she was alive now, she would be here today on her birthday. She'd be celebrating with us. She'd be celebrating by marching with us. She would say, overrule the court. She would tell us today, as she said then, that cautious, careful people always casting about to preserve their reputation and social standing never can bring about a reform. Those who are really in earnest must be willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly and privately, in season or out. She was a founding mother of our country. She was a founding mother of what this country is today. And her part in renewing America included constitutional amendments. And did she and her sisters and her brothers ever succeed? They won the 13th, the 14th, the 15th amendments, abolition, expansion of equal protection, black suffrage. Those were hard won. Those amendments took the destruction of the slave power to accomplish them. And did they rest there? No. They won the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage. A great victory we look back on today. And they spent their entire lives in those struggles. And would anyone here venture to say that those lives were spent in vain? That those gains were not well won? No. On a future day, a multitude will gather here on these steps, and they will look back at what we dare to do here today. And they will thank you. They will thank you. And you're not alone. In addition to the many hundreds of Wisconsinites gathered here today, there are tens of thousands more who have signed the motion to amend the Constitution at MoveToAmend.org. And those people are organizing. They're not organizing in Washington, D.C. alone. They're organizing in Alaska, in Colorado, in Florida, in Texas, all across this country, across the Mississippi and Iowa. There are people who are organizing to build this movement to amend the Constitution. It is stirring. Let's do that too. Let's go to D.C. We move, all of us, we move that the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights are the rights of human beings, not corporations. Do I hear agreement?
Yeah.
We move that the unlimited use of money to influence elections is incompatible with a principle of equal protection. Do I hear agreement?
Yeah.
We move that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged. Do I hear agreement?
Yeah.
We make these motions and more to amend the Constitution and to overrule and to overcome the damage the court has done to democracy. Just blocks from here stands a federal courthouse. And I ask you, shall we deliver our motion so that the nation hears it?
I'm so pleased to see so many people out today, and I was thinking about the fact that there were 600 people registered for the Tea Party convention, and that got nationwide news. You know, 600. I think between us and our friends on Facebook, we could outmatch that in a couple days, right?
Yeah.
So,
take back the media.
Take back the media. So let me talk to you a little about the Supreme Court. I do think that the fact that there hasn't been an impeachment proceeding even brought, even really talked about, is a huge problem. The fact is that there's been a revolution on the Supreme Court that's been 30 years in the making. This is the product of Reagan's ideological effort to pack the courts. Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, Justice Kennedy have all been part of the Federalist Society effort to remake our law. They've been doing it for over 20 years, 30 years now in the making. And if we didn't think Bush v. Gore was enough to tell us that there's something seriously wrong with the Supreme Court, this certainly must wake us up to the fact that the Supreme Court has been taken over by not conservatives, but by radicals in black clothing. When I was working for the Senate Judiciary Committee in the first Bush administration in 2001 through 2002 through 2004, I fought to try to protect the courts from this takeover. We fought to filibuster nominees like Miguel Estrada, like William Haynes from the Defense Department, who was trying to get on the Fourth Circuit and maybe make it to the Supreme Court. We fought unsuccessfully against Justice Roberts making it to the D.C. Circuit. These were long battles in the trenches, and then after Bush won election in 2004, the court fell. The court fell. And this is a crucial issue for us in terms of this debate going forward. This court, this five-person majority, these five guys, they're in their 50s and their 60s. They're there for a while. We've got a lot to fight about. There are some great laws in terms of public finance, in terms of keeping foreign corporations out of our elections, in terms of requiring corporate approval of shareholders. Those are all very important measures. But we have to think as well that this court, this majority, is going to be there for many years. And they have demonstrated their determination to strike down sensible legislation intended to protect the sacred nature of our democracy and intended to protect the free speech rights of people. So this is a battle. This is the beginning of a battle. We're going to work on legislation. We're going to work on amendments. And the Center for Media and Democracy strongly supports amending the Constitution. We think this is a crucial effort over the long haul. It's not easy, but it's got to start somewhere. And the Reagan Revolution, the fact of the Federalist Society, the seating of these judges for this court started with a handful of people in Washington who were determined to remake our law. And we can counter that effort. It may take time. It will take time. But we've got to come together to say that we're in it for the long haul. We have a vision for our future, and our vision isn't one of corporate democracy.
Woo!
So there are a lot of things we can do. One of the things we're doing at SourceWatch is trying to document the corporate rights arguments and the corporate the amendments against corporate rights, and talk about which corporations are involved in influencing our elections and the type of spin and propaganda they're putting out there. We know in the coming election and in the coming elections, there are going to be numerous claims about regulating corporations killing jobs. That's going to be the new mantra. But the fact is that we need regulation of corporations. We need to ensure that people like Karen Silkwood don't just have a job, but have a safe job. We need to ensure that Lilly Ledbetter doesn't just have a job at unequal pay, but actually has equal pay. And these are the types of regulations that are going to be under assault by these corporations and by corporations who are trying to buy members of Congress through tanking their opponents or through supporting feel-good ads for the people they choose. We've got to stand up to that. And we've got to come together and realize that this isn't a one-day rally. It's not a one-week rally. It's not a one-month rally. It's not even a one-year rally. But together, we can change the direction of our country, and we can do it if we unite across the country with not just in Wisconsin, but cities and states around the nation. Let me just conclude by giving a shout out to some of these great signs. Shame on you, right, for the Supreme Court. Shame on you. We've got corporations aren't people. We've got free speech means little if you can't be heard. We've got the Supreme Court betrays us. We've got overrule the court. Citizen elections funded now. We the people, not we the corporations. No mind, no heart, no voice. Move to amend the Constitution. So, we've got a lot of work to do, and your words are more eloquent than mine, I'm sure.
We are building the movement at the state level, not in Washington, D.C. This is not a lobbying campaign. This is a movement from below, built in the states. We're going to our legislators because they are our neighbors, they are close to us, we can find them, and we can let them know that we're going to hold them accountable.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.